face our fears, know what you don't know what you do know, and feel confident with asking the right questions.
Welcome back to the Neurophilia Podcast. I am your host, Neuber Goyal. In today's episode, we will be discussing the relationship between neurology and medicine. While we have highlighted the relationship between neurology and other important fields, such as cardiology or psychiatry, perhaps there is no field more intimately connected with neurology than medicine. As Jose Biller writes, neurology is closer to internal medicine than any other specialty. Justifiably, neurologists are reverting back to their role as internists of the nervous system. An estimated 7 to 10% of patients will present with a neurological complaint to their general practitioner. In the inpatient setting, 10 to 20% of patients will have a primary neurological problem or experience a neurological complication during their hospital admission. These numbers continue to rise with our growing geriatric population. Common neurological conditions seen and managed by general practitioners include headaches, neuropathy, dizziness, neurodegenerative conditions, and dementia. For more information on all statistics and studies mentioned, please check out our episode's description. By 2025, there will be an estimated 20% shortfall of neurologists in our country. While the obvious answer is to train more neurologists, there is a movement to restore a healthy and more communicative relationship between primary and secondary care. Paul Morish writes, "It is in the interest of patients for primary care to take a central role in diagnosis, and when necessary, the long-term management of neurological and neurodegenerative disease." The purpose of today's episode is to discuss the relationship between neurology and medicine and better clarify the role of primary and secondary care in treating neurological diseases. To accomplish this, I have with me Neurophilia co-host and vascular neurologist, Dr. Blake Bolecko, and two very special guests, Dr. Deborah Plate and Dr. Austin Fredrickson. Dr. Deborah Plate is a board-certified family medicine physician. She is currently the chair and clinical associate director at the Center for Family Medicine Residency Program at Cleveland Clinic Akron General. She has a private practice and loves caring for her patients, some of whom she has cared for over 30 years. Dr. Austin Fredrickson is an associate professor of internal medicine at NeoMed and a board-certified general internist practicing primary care in his hometown of Salem, Ohio. He serves in medical leadership positions at the state and national levels and is currently his county's deputy coroner, although Dr. Fredrickson's greatest claim to fame may be that he was a pupil of the infamous Dr. Deborah Plate. Dr. Bolecko, it is wonderful to see you again, and Drs. Plate and Fredrickson, welcome to the Neurophilia Podcast. It is such an honor to have you here with us.
Thank you, Neuber. Nice to be here.
It is so cool to be a part of this thing. I'm so impressed.
We are so proud, aren't we, Austin?
I couldn't be more proud. So I've watched your TED Talks. I've seen your presentations through school. This is maybe the pinnacle of what you're able to do with your communicative skills. Keep it up. Well done.
I very much appreciate that. And we are just, I can't even express how excited we are to have you here on the podcast. And so I just want to jump straight into what is sure to be a very exciting and meaningful conversation. And the first question that I have, you know, Dr. Plate, Dr. Fredrickson, what neurological conditions do you typically see in the outpatient setting, and which ones are you the most comfortable with managing?
Certainly, Neuber, as a family doc, we see quite a bit. We're oftentimes on the forefront of some potentially very, very serious things. You know, I can't tell you how many patients come to me concerned about movement. Gee, when I walk, I can't stop as I get to the curb, or I'm shuffling, or I'm noticing something going on with dad or grandma. Headaches, very common. Neuropathy, very common. Bell's palsy, benign positional vertigo. Is it really vertigo, benign positional? Is it many errors, or is it potentially a stroke that we need to be concerned about? So we certainly see see quite a bit. My job is to make sure that the headache that I'm seeing with this patient is not related to the person perhaps that they live at home with, but truly something that we need to be concerned about. And I say that half joking, but we really are very into the psychosocial aspect of what's going on with these folks as well. So important to be able to sift through some of those things.
I would add to that list everything that Dr. Blades said. I think neuropathy is really prevalent. I think tremor is something that we deal with a lot. What is it? Is it benign? Is it essential? Is it something that we need to be more concerned about? And then dementia. So where I practice in a more rural setting, not only do we not have neurologists, we don't have geriatricians. So we end up having to pretend to be neurologists a whole lot more than we would in those tertiary centers that we trained in.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, especially, you know, Dr. Play being at this large residency program, having residents there, and then Dr. Fredrickson contrasting that being in a more rural era. You guys have such different, you know, perspectives and experiences with neurology. And so I'm wondering, how comfortable do you feel with treating neurological disease?
You know, I would say, as Austin talks about his situation, that really we have neurology at our fingertips. Very easy to message, very easy to have a phone call. I round at the hospital as well, and we've got 3 cases in right now, Nuber, of stroke, catatonic state, and pseudo seizures. So, you know, neurology, psychiatry, and they're on our service as primary care. And so it's something that we are consistently weekly interacting. And so I would say our interactions are frequent. And what I love is that we have easy access. In the past, for me, there was always a distance with that relationship. And so being able to really be in the hospital setting and the office setting, I think allows for us to have some great communication and ease of communication. And so that has worked out very well, I think, for us as primary care docs here on the campus of Cleveland Clinic Akron General and rounding, you know, with the bridge in the hospital right next door. So we literally at times can roll our patients, Austin, right from here, office, right over to emergency room or to their hospital bed. You know, here we are training primary care docs who also are getting, I think, a bit more at ease with neurology and exposure to it more than we ever have before because of shortage and because of the fact that we are at the front door of what's going on.
Deb, I'm curious, if you didn't have that relationship with the neurology group, as maybe you haven't in the past, and you had to put on a scale of 1 to 10, how comfortable are you managing these patients on your own that come in with a primary neurologic complaint? What would you place it at?
You know, I would say to you 5 to 6 at this point, I think. Sometimes I like their backing. Depends on the condition. Many of the things that Austin and I have mentioned, I think we feel very comfortable. But there are some things where I like that backing with regards to movement disorders and what might be the appropriate treatment.
And I'm sure it's going to be different for everybody, but when you have a neurology group at your fingertips, say, which, and Austin may, you know, kind of comment on the other side of this, do you feel more comfortable or do you feel less comfortable with your own management of those patients because you're now kind of just saying, I feel comfortable in the plan that I have to get them to the neurologist, but I maybe am not managing these patients as much as what I once was?
Good question. Oftentimes, as I teach the residents, if you come to precept, you come with your patient and your history and your concern, but you also come with a plan. And so if I'm going to consult with a neurologist through messaging, I'm going to let them know what I think is going on and what my plan is and say, hey, what are your thoughts? As opposed to, gee, sending you over because I'm not sure what's going on. That doesn't mean that doesn't occur, but I like to try and give them my thoughts and see what their thoughts are beyond that.
Well, I'm almost the dichotomous opposite here of access and relationships. I'm from Columbiana County. That's the one that touches both West Virginia and Pennsylvania, where the East Palestine train explosion derailment just happened. We got about 100,000 people in our county, and we have one neurologist. I think we have one psychiatrist, not even full-time per se. We have no geriatricians that I'm aware of. Maybe one's hiding somewhere. So we honestly still will send out over an hour away to where Dr. Play works at Akron General. We'll send up to Cleveland, but we have a lot of health disparities in rural population with transportation, with their education, with their ability to access people virtually, because good portion of our county doesn't have high-speed internet access, even if they could afford to get the high-speed internet access. So I'd say that coming out of training in an environment that Dr. Plate described, and then heading back into Mayberry, my initial comfort level was very low, but the expectation and the frequency with which I would have to see neurological patients and complaints was very high. And so that discrepancy has narrowed with time. And then to answer that second question of, well, does that make me feel more or less confident? In some ways, my diagnosis remains final because no one's challenging me. They don't really have a backup consultant to ask, is that an age-related tremor or is that hemibolismus? You know, what's this doc thinking? And for better or worse, the patients don't necessarily have a lot of resources themselves to double check. So I am interpreting some MRIs. I am begging people to get EMGs, and we're doing more testing than I would have had to do. But with time and experience, you develop enough clinical acumen to realize this still remains in my wheelhouse. And then, okay, I've gone through a couple rings of this algorithm, and time to phone a friend wherever I can get one.
Austin, I'm curious, a little bit of a different question for you then. At what percentage of patients that walk through your door do you think have either a primary neurologic complaint or a secondary systemic kind of complication complaint that involves something from the nervous system standpoint?
I'd say multiple a day, at least 20%, which is, it sounds high, but it's not when you think about just how prevalent, I mean, neuropathy, a headache, you know, all of these things that we see, they're coming for so much in primary care. I mean, we talked about the shortage of neurologists. The AMC reported that there'd be 24,000 shortages of PCPs in 2025. So we don't have enough docs to even provide primary preventative and chronic care, let alone compensate for the lack of neurologists. That's the trouble, is that it's really pervasive. How many patients I know of is one answer, but the real question is, how many patients don't I know because no one else is checking them? How many things have I not seen, but they've seen me?
That is extremely powerful, what you just said, Dr. Fredrickson. I really appreciate hearing both of your perspectives and hearing how over time, with experience, with that constant encounter with neurology, even though it might not be something that you were directly looking for, but it kept coming at you, you do gain that confidence in being able to treat neurological conditions. So thank you both for your answers. And you know, while I've spent most of the introduction talking about how much neurology there is in medicine, there's probably a lot more medicine in neurology. And, you know, many of our patients with neurological disease will have coexisting medical conditions, or their neurological prognosis is directly influenced by general medical factors. And so I'm wondering, Dr. Bileko, as a neurologist, as a subspecialist, what is your comfort level with treating general medical complaints outside of neurology?
Yeah, Newport, it's a great question. And I'm sitting here asking, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your comfort? And it's like, well, tables have turned. What's your comfort level in managing hypertension and diabetes and hyperlipidemia? And listen, as a stroke neurologist specifically, we manage a lot of vascular risk factors. And we do this a lot together with patients, internists or family practitioner or nurse practitioner, whoever is managing as their primary care provider, we manage a lot of these together. But I would say that there's kind of two realms of what I do from a medicine standpoint. One is the inpatient medicine that I'm doing, and then two is the outpatient kind of risk factor management from a stroke standpoint. And so I think that you have to be somewhat comfortable with both of those if you're managing complex patients in the hospital. And we have primary services here, being an academic tertiary care center. So I don't have the luxury of just saying, oh, the hospitalist team is taking care of that. Oh, the hospitalist team is taking care of that. You know, no, we are. We're taking care of the patient. And with that means that if we have to consult somebody, you know, what are we going to use them for? And ultimately, as a primary provider, you still are responsible for the overall care of that patient, not just for their stroke, not just for coming in for an MS exacerbation or new onset seizure. You're responsible for every medical comorbidity that they have while they're in the hospital and what's happening at that time. And so I'll be honest with you, you know, we do 1 year of internal medicine, and that 1 year now has even been liberated a little bit in the sense that it's 8 months of internal medicine as a requirement. You know, my internal medicine knowledge comes from residents that are coming up every single year with new knowledge. And if you don't take it upon yourself to learn what the latest and greatest is to manage these comorbidities, then you're not doing right on a primary service. But I think that as a subspecialist, if you're either taking a primary role in the patient's overall care and not just doing a one and done consult, or you're a primary inpatient neurologist, I think it is your responsibility to at least have enough knowledge within medicine to feel comfortable caring for the whole patient.
So on a scale from 1 to 10, how comfortable do you feel treating medical conditions?
No, medical conditions, or the conditions that I often see with neurological patients, I think are two different things. The medical conditions, as could I be an internist or a GP right now? 3, 2.5, maybe. Maybe for what I see that's more prominent in my patient population, I don't know, 7.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit, and I wanted to bring up this article that was published in 1990, and it was titled, What a Family Physician Should Know About Neurology. And basically, the main summary taken away from this article is that many general practitioners stray away from taking a central role in treating neurological patients because of difficulty either conducting a neurological exam, difficulty interpreting results, deciding next step in management, developing a positive attitude towards neurological disease in general. You know, Drs. Plate and Fredrickson, both of you have sort of hinted at the fact that your confidence with neurological disease management has come over time. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about what those barriers are for that you've experienced in becoming comfortable with neurology, or that you see other general practitioners encounter.
Yeah, Nupur, I think it's a great question as a primary care doc, family medicine physician. Remember, I've had the best of both worlds. I was out in private practice and somewhat isolated, really literally from the medical campus. And so that was a very different world. And when you talk about neurophobia, I could absolutely certainly identify with that. I found that my confidence improved when I was back here teaching and teaching the neuro exam, you know, through physical diagnosis lab. So in order to teach, you have to really make sure that you have a good feel, not only how to do, but why you are doing it. And I encourage a lot of my colleagues out in the community, boy, if you don't have med students joining you, I encourage you to do so. As Blake indicates and Austin has indicated, teaching is a great way to certainly stay up with our medical knowledge and all that is changing.
So then, even thinking back to preclinical medical education, I would pee in my pants if you asked me to outline the tract of the anterior lateral spinothalamic tract. Like, I don't remember these things. The way we teach the neuroanatomy is sometimes so discordant from its clinical application that we freak out that we won't be able to remember the vascular supply of the parietal lobe. And then say, oh crap, there's some white spots on the MRI. That means something. I don't really remember. And so we're not really trained, unless you continue into that neurology field, to say, okay, let's integrate all the levels that we've learned up to this point, from histopath all the way through imaging. And as Dr. Plate said, physical exam, that it's scary. And neurologists, generalizing and essentializing the stereotype of a neurologist, typically has many cerebral questions to ask you in follow-up. And we all remember, well, this answer won't go on forever. One time he'll ask me something I don't know the answer to. And so it's easy to retreat and say, oh yeah, just consult neurology about that. I think a big barrier is that it is whisked away. I mean, a lot of our stroke patients leave us from the ER immediately into the stroke ward, right? And so unless you're serving time in the stroke ward, you may not see those acute strokes. Unless you're dealing with patients in an MS center, you may not be treating MS patients. You automatically assign, oh, the subspecialist is managing, neuromanaging, continue to follow, you know. And so because it's been segmented not just into neuro and not neuro, but even in the fields of neuro, it's really hard to feel comfortable. It's a real nuanced, nebulous specialty that requires a lot of training, which is why we're lucky to have the neurologists we do.
As a primary care doc, I think for both Austin and I, some of the folks that I thought of as we were prepping for this session, I'm dealing with the aftermath of that. I've got a patient with ALS. I've got a patient with MS. I've got a patient who just had a stroke who tried to go back to work, and they're asking her to be at a level that she cannot get to. You know, that's the value, I think, of our relationships. You know, Dr. Blake, as the neurologist, is able to help locate and guide us treatment-wise and diagnostic-wise. And then, you know, the relationships and how this impacts everyday living with their families. You know, this one woman who's just had her stroke, the husband's frustrated because she can't get things right. Work is looking to really look for any which way to get her out of the company after being there for 30 years. So here I am, her advocate, attempting to try to navigate this and make sure she has everything she needs. Meanwhile, we still have tachycardia, waiting on a TEE to be done. I'm coordinating all these things that have occurred and trying to be, you know, the her person, her go-to, to make sure we get her to a point where she's comfortable. And Austin, you speak to being the internist in a small area where those relationships are so vital beyond the diagnosis. Would you agree?
Patients, I was consulted by a nurse for as a specialist, right? I'm a general internist, and she brings in this wailing hemiballistic advanced Huntington's chorea. And he's had it for years, and he's suppressed it kind of just with drinking and living with it. He's like, yeah, we think you should manage this. And that's such a discordant disconnect between what the patient assumes you know versus what I know, in which in no world would I be your primary manager of Huntington's chorea telling you anything about it at all. So it is, you become what they expect you to become. You do your best and then bone the friend as soon as possible.
Austin, you had mentioned the subspecialization of a lot of specialists, but definitely prominent in neurology with over 30 different subspecialties of neurology these days. And the question is, as a general practitioner or as an internist, do you get frustrated when you have a patient who comes in with a neuro complaint of where to get that patient, or if the patient sees an ultra subspecialized, sorry, I'm a vascular neurologist, but I only focus on the left anterior cerebral artery. And if a stroke happens outside of that, I'm not your guy. Do you get frustrated that patients go and see someone like that? And it's either, I'm not the right person for you, or here you go back and manage this with your primary doc. Because I'll be honest with you, as a neurologist who values general neurology, there's a lot of conversation around, is the general neurologist a dying breed? And it's frustrating for me to see patients who come in and see me for a stroke in the office, and they're referred by another neurologist. And then I find out they have a headache neurologist, they have a seizure neurologist, they have a neuropathy neurologist, a neuromuscular doc. And then they come and see me for a stroke. And I say, whoa, 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 whoa. If we within our own field have four or five different subspecialists managing this patient, I can only imagine how it would be as an internist to try to corral the team and make it sound like you know what's going on for your patients. And so I promise you, it's a two-part question. One is, are you as frustrated as we get sometimes about the super subspecialization that occurs? And two, as an internist who is the quarterback for that patient, how do you manage that? And what can we do as subspecialists to make that easier for you to come back with a patient and say, this is what we're going to do?
So yes, I am more frustrated than you are. And my frustration is dwarfed by my patients and their families, because if I'm sending them to the Mellon Center up at Cleveland Clinic, that's world renowned, again, it's an hour and a half away with good traffic. It's $10 for a parking ticket. You know, it's time they're taking off work. And if that's the third neurologist they saw, because the local neurologist, they waited 3 to 6 months to even get the appointment scheduled, said, we should get you in with a specialist, sent that specialist to an MS specialist. And then the MS specialist says, actually, these are just white spots. And you know what? You have, on biopsy, small fiber neuropathy. So you need to see a neuromuscular specialist. And apparently, there's a neuromuscular specialist, which, oh, podunk internist had no idea that this patient should be seeing a neuromuscular specialist. And actually, apparently, there's a good neuromuscular specialist in Pittsburgh and not this one. And what should we do? And well, then we call and get the neuromuscular specialist involved for a patient who has been over a year unable to get disability and is deteriorating in front of us with an unclear diagnosis, who has not had steroids or IVIG or 100 other weird neurologic treatments that I don't know anything about. And I'm just begging somebody to help them. But yeah, you're going to wait another 3 months to see them, and they're putting you back with an MS specialist in Pitt. But no, they saw the MS specialist, and what the hell are we all doing? So yes, the frustration only mounts. And to get an answer for these really nebulous questions is so hard. I really don't know where to start. And my patients rely on me to know that. And it's very difficult.
Quick comment with that as well, Austin. I appreciate your frustration and share that at times as well. I have found the messaging within the system very helpful. That if I have who, and I will tell you, I get on sometimes right with the patient in the room and start looking at, okay, what are the, looking at certain physicians within a department, like to see what their specialties are. Hey, look, here's someone who has exactly what I think we have, what we need. And we'll talk about it. And then I will message that patient, physician to make sure that that is a good match. That takes time. Sometimes I'm doing that in the evening as I'm working on charts or what have you. But I think both of us try to target that as best we can. But I do a lot of background work to try and make that happen as best as possible. Because you're right, patients lean on us and rely on us for an accurate consult and for one that is going to be a good experience, which is a huge issue. Many of mine will comment and say, G-Plate, you know, I appreciate who you sent me to. And I often will say, I will send you where I would send myself or a family member. And that is very powerful. But that takes work behind the scenes, as we would both agree, I'm sure.
I'm on first name basis with a couple of the Cleveland Clinic neurologists, and now I can add another to my list here. And I say, God, please help me, because I don't know what to do. And this patient's hoping to get better. And usually when you present that vulnerably and allow any physician to take that Superman role of help us, please, like, we're not asking for a miracle. We're just asking for your expertise. Almost every time they rise to the occasion and do a fantastic job.
Austin, do you have any ability to do any virtual consults down there? I know in some of the smaller ERs, neurology was doing some of the virtual consults. Is there anything like that there?
We have stroke neurology. I'll have patients come to my office to access virtual if we have power. And then I've had patients, McDonald's has had free Wi-Fi hotspots. So even coming to me, some of my patients come from West Virginia and Pennsylvania and drive an hour to see me, let alone, and you know, go up to Cleveland for another hour and a half. Right. So I even connect with those who can virtually.
That's great that you have a hub too. I mean, how special that they can do some of their subspecialty consults right there. I mean, what a service that is even for them. And as a little side fun thing that I just want to know as the neurologist in me, do you both have your blanket diagnoses that you say, I need to get this patient into a neurologist? I don't know exactly how to do this, but a TIA sounds like my ticket in. This is a safe space, I promise.
it's easier to answer which ones don't work really well. So I found if you call someone an intractable migraine, they can't get in very fast. You have to use the word like acute headache, and they can be seen very quickly. But if you call it intractable, it might take weeks or months before they get into the migraine clinic. Same with sudden focal neurologic deficits. It doesn't seem to work very well. Deb, what are your favorites?
Yeah, I mean, a TIA is always safe because it was there, it's gone, and it might be something perhaps. So I can't say I haven't utilized that. I think the one thing that I would say to you, Austin, you and I would both remember Dinah Fadina. Dr. Yes. Fadina was my mentor when I was here in residency. She was one of the faculty members here. And she pulled us aside one day rounding and said, as primary care docs, you are the patient advocate. You are the link to the rest of the system. And I never forgot that. And so as we speak to these folks, these different patients with neurologic concerns that we're concerned about, that we know may be beyond what we have, I see it as my duty, and I see that Dr. Fredrickson sees it as his duty to make sure that we link them to where they belong. We are the advocates, and trying to get our latest generation in medical education to appreciate that and understand that, I think, is certainly our mission. But I really am very passionate about that.
I came up with two. Guillain-Barré gets in pretty quick. Meningitis gets in pretty quickly as well. Both of those sneak in real quickly. Increased intracranial pressure may or may not, but once you call it meningitis or Guillain-Barré, they seem to get in the next day or two real fast.
Austin, I'm going to flag your name in the system.
It's been flagged. That's why I can't get anybody anywhere. They know. They should stop accepting stuff from this guy.
Well, my face is hurting from smiling so much because, I mean, this is just such a wonderful conversation. And I mean, to your point, Dr. Play, about you being a patient advocate, that's so clear even from this conversation, because with all these patients, you know, you're talking about the neurological diseases that, you know, they have to figure out. But in each example, you're talking about the time for transportation, the cost of these medications, the overall time it takes from that diagnosis to be able to get that relief from their neurological disease. I think it's pretty phenomenal. And we just need to find a better way to connect these two and have it be working on the same team versus in opposition. And a huge point, you know, obviously we need to increase the number of general practitioners. We need to increase the number of neurologists. We need to find better ways to be comfortable with treating these diseases. But a huge point of contention actually is, when is it the appropriate time to consult? And so I want to bring up the study. It was performed in 2004, and it was a study that included general internists, family physicians, and neurologists. And they were given questionnaires regarding the management of three different neurological cases. One that was a transient cerebrovascular event that no longer will be allowed to get you in to see a neurologist quickly, I assume, after this conversation. Dementia and Parkinson's disease. And what's really interesting is that for all three of those cases, neurologists felt that the patient should be referred much more, significantly so, than the internist and primary care physicians. And so I have a lot of questions about this. My first question is, why do you think this discrepancy exists?
You know, my thought is, Anupur, as I hear that question, there's such a variance out there when it comes to family medicine, GPs, whatever our language may be. You know, there are many who have been out for many years, or others who are extremely academic. And so there's going to be various comfort levels, I think, with regards to that. And so I think that that's going to be somewhat fragmented depending on where they come from. There are times, and Austin, I'm sure, can potentially agree with this, that patients will encourage us to say, gee, I really would like to go see. And we talk about that. Then I have others that say, really, Plate, do I need to do that? Can't we just keep doing? And then we talk about life expectancy and what are they comfortable with? And, you know, if we do this and we find this is where we're heading, I don't want that. And so I think really having a conversation as a patient advocate, getting a feel for where they are, meeting them where they are, becomes very, very important. And so what's right for one is not going to be right necessarily for another. And so I think just making sure we have a good feel, and that's the beauty of, I think, us and our relationships, is we have a very good feel for our patients, where they come from and what their expectations are.
I don't say things as eloquently as you. Most of the time, I'd say. And the way I phrase it is, neurologists are probably used to getting a lot of crappy consults. And so seeing a bunch of crappy consults, they probably think, oh my God, these PCPs, what the hell do they know? You know, they're sending me BS all the time. And maybe I should really be the one managing all these things. Whereas, as Dr. Plate described, there's some outstanding internists and family physicians out there who can absolutely manage multiple levels of neurologic complaints. And so neither one surprises me. I think there's some biases there that they come from cognitive shortcuts from their past experience. PCPs know them for a long time and feel comfortable continuing the relationship. Neurologists have been dumped on so often that they feel more comfortable managing this more complicated case of neurologic issues.
And I do think it's so important to know what we don't know. That is one thing that we teach, and we get very concerned when we have a doc or a resident that doesn't know what they don't know. So I think that's a very important thing to hear us say. In no way do we feel like we have this great knowledge neurowise, but we do know the patient in front of us. And if I know, and if I can perhaps even message Dr. Blake and say, hey, you know, this is what I'm thinking. Any thoughts, anything else you might add? They might say, hey, send them up. Let me take a peek. Great.
Newper, should I steal your line? Beautifully said. That's what Newper would say right now. I know she's thinking it. So I can't agree with you more. And I think the underlying tone and the underlying word, and I just wrote it on a piece of paper in front of me and I circled it, was trust. These patients trust their primary docs. You all know them. You know their family. You know their situation. You know the barriers that they may face. If somebody comes up and sees me as a consultant, I also love the longitudinal relationship that I get to form with patients. Different people as stroke neurologists, I know that we all come across as give me acute stroke or give me nothing at all, right? Just give me that Tenecta place, put it in my hand, let me get this patient to the angio suite. But to be honest with you, forming connections long-term to patients is a big reason why I went into medicine. And so if I wasn't able to do that as a subspecialist, I wouldn't be very happy. And so as much as I try to develop that rapport and I try to do it quickly, we've talked about a lot of things that are hard for me to do this with. One is that our patients travel quite a lot to come and see us. It's a lot harder to, and the virtual world has made this a little bit easier. We can do check-ins, we can do virtual visits, but even getting patients up here to main campus is a challenge. Nobody wants to come up here and park and try to get through. And all these academic institutions, no patient likes to go there. I can almost promise you that. Maybe there's a few out there, but the majority of them don't like to go there. And then 9 times out of 10, if I think from a stroke standpoint that something needs to be changed, a medication, a physical therapy regimen, a diet, something that they are doing, what do you think patients tell me? Well, can you touch base with my PCP? Well, my PCP said X, Y, and Z. Well, et cetera, et cetera. And so how powerful is that, that they just view PCPs, you know, every time I start thinking the PCP doesn't know crap, the PCP is this forgotten person, the PCP doesn't do anything anymore. What is this person on my schedule for? That is very, very, very small in the grand scheme of things, as far as how many patients come to me and you can just see how much they trust in their family physician or their internist. And so if there's nobody else who has told you both in the last week that your patients care about you, I can at least tell you that your patients care about you and they trust in you, and the families do too. I always tell the residents too, if someone's asking you to see a patient, whether it's outpatient, inpatient, you going and seeing that patient is going to do some good. Whether it's a BS consult that you say, this is ridiculous, you're going to go and you're going to find something different that someone else missed. You're going to go and put that patient at ease. You're going to help the people who consulted you because they either weren't taking the time with the patient to figure it out, or they just truly couldn't figure it out, even if it comes across simple for us. And so you can always help the patient, even if it's not making the diagnosis or coming up with a different treatment plan. You always help by seeing that patient in one way or another. You always help. And so my biggest struggle is if I want to change a medication or two, but I'm only seeing that patient every 6 months, if they're stable from a stroke standpoint, and then they go back to the PCP and the PCP says, well, sorry, Dr. Boletko changed this medication for you 4 months ago when I sent you up there for a consult. You have to do this one medication through him now and I'll do all your other ones. This is where they value you all so much, but then whenever it seems like they're dismissed or now the specialist is taking care of you, that's the time where I start to see the patients lose a little bit of faith in who is really taking care of me.
And I would advocate for the team aspect of that, and hope that a lot of our colleagues who might be listening, I'm certainly always willing, unless it's a med I'm really uncomfortable with, I often say, let's keep this simple. Let's put it all in together, knowing that we're on the same team. You were good enough to affirm or diagnose. And even that affirmation, Blake, as you talk about going into the room, sometimes for us, it's affirmation and say, you know what, Dr. Blake, he thought exactly what you would. That is very powerful for us to have you even affirm. It may have felt like, gee, you know, I got 20 consults on the list. But for us, that is very, very powerful and builds that trust, not only with us, but also then with our Cleveland Clinic or our folks that are up at a main international facility. So there's great power in that.
Beautifully said, Blake. Said. And honestly, Deb, too, because this is that sort of handoff, especially in between health systems. So I'm an independent hospital. I'm not in anybody's messaging system. I think the most helpful thing that I get taking over patients after they've seen any subspecialist, because I too have the tendency to bow down. The stroke neurologist thought you needed to be on a Flozin. Well, God forbid you have 12 more UTIs, but like, they put you on it and I don't want you to have a stroke, so let's continue indefinitely. Like, no, come on, like, know what you know. And that's the trouble, is some, you start talking about certain anticonvulsants, I really don't know a lot about them. But if it's in the wheelhouse, and if it's not, a really helpful line is, hey, I've been filling this patient's whatever, and all they need to do is can be continued on it indefinitely as long as they don't have a breakthrough seizure. And please monitor this level with this frequency. Oh, great. I saw it. I need it. I know what I do now. And even if I felt comfortable, I'm not dismissed by that. It's a nice reminder. Oh, I need to check that level once I put a pop-up in. But it gives me guidance. And I don't think anyone would feel demeaned with a gentle thing to say, comfortable with PCP continuing with these parameters.
Beautifully said.
you still say it better. We can't top it. It gets me every time.
Dr. Vallejo, something that we have been talking a lot about is know what you should know. And so I'm wondering, as a neurologist, as a vascular neurologist, what do you expect general practitioners to know about neurology?
I'm okay if this is variable. I think that Deb said it beautifully earlier when she stated that you have to know your own limitations. You have to have that conversation with the patient. And it's not just what you know or what you're comfortable with. What does the patient want? You have that long-term relationship with the patient. What is your collective plan together? And I think bare minimum, what's really nice and what I always appreciate and even makes simple consults a little bit better is, one, if someone thought about the patient, and then two, is there a question for me? You know, it's very hard when we see patients, we're meeting them for the first time, often coming from other systems where they don't get their care here. And then they hit us with a stack of papers and a couple discs that they had from 10 years ago. And they say, something's going on with me. You have 45 minutes. And I expect when I leave here to have an answer that I can take back to my primary care. And I say, well, why did your primary care doc send you up here in the first place? And I can't tell you how many patients said, I don't know. I don't know why I'm here. My primary doc said I need to come and see a neurologist. And so I would advocate the other way, that one, as long as you're thoughtful and as long as you have a question, that's the bare minimum that we would ask for. The second thing is, a lot of our neuro patients, they don't always wrap their head around why they're seeing a specialist. And so repetition, or however you can relay this to family members, however many times it takes for you to say, you're going in there armed and ready. Here's your stack of papers. Tell them this is why you are going to be here. That would be extremely powerful. And it puts some sense of ownership on the patient as well, not just between some doc where I can't read their notes anyway, and then us. So put the power in the hands of the patients and really make sure that they understand why they're seeing us as well. It saves us a lot of time.
Well, you know, we're sitting here talking about neurology and primary care, Austin, Blake, Newper. And I had a dear patient of mine who called me and said, oh my God, I feel like I am having a stroke. She literally had some dysarthria, fuzzy, foggy, really struggling. And of course, this was after hours. We sent her to the emergency room. We get her down to the emergency room and the ER doc's getting a history and they're doing a full workup. The resident calls, our resident calls, because we do admit some of these folks with neuro on consult. And we're talking and I said, did you ask her if there was anything different than usual? Okay, basic stuff, guys, basic stuff to my resident. No, Dr. Bailey, I said, call me back. Just talk to her. I said, this lady is written. You know, I know this patient, known her for 30 years. Anything different than usual? She calls me back and she says, Dr. Playton. I said, yes. She said her son just called and said, Mom, did you eat those brownies on the counter? And the patient said, sure. She was over her son's house that day cleaning. And he had some wonderful fresh brownies there on the counter and she had eaten a brownie. And of course the brownies had marijuana in them. So here she was high as a kite thinking she was having a stroke when really, you know, all the great questions were asked, but there were a couple questions that could have been asked just a step further. And there was our diagnosis. So luckily not a stroke. She was able to go home fairly quickly after things cleared.
I can at least vouch for saying that I've hopped on a lot of telestrokes and seen very similar stories. Yeah. And so you're not the only one. She's not the only one. This happens quite a lot. And in the flurry of time is brain, you know, sometimes that history almost takes a back seat.
Sure.
And so half of what I do whenever I get this frantic call that's saying, patient, it's a pre-hospital notification coming in, slurred speech, difficulty walking. The first thing that you have to remember whenever you get on screen isn't to just look at the CT scan and start trying to do this robotic telestroke exam. It's what happened, you know, talk to me. What is different now than what it was? And then you get so much information so quickly. And so it's just, it's funny. And I'm smiling over here because I'm like, this happens all the time. You never even think about it. So anyway, I love the story and I appreciate it. And I think that there's a very valuable message in there. Yes. Also.
I absolutely love that, Dr. Play. The importance of storytelling and the power some brownies can hold.
There you go.
So, you know, the focus of the first season of Neurophilia is obviously to help talk about neurophobia, which is the fear of clinical neurology experienced by medical students as well as young resident doctors. And, you know, I first want to ask both of you, Drs. Plate, Drs. Frederickson, have you ever experienced neurophobia?
When you first used the word neurophobia, I was actually afraid that I had missed a diagnosis of neurophobia. So, yeah, that's the threshold with which my sphincters tighten when you throw neurologic words at me.
That's great. And?
Nooper, I think that was a yes, maybe.
I'd say neurophobia is just, it goes away each year. It's exposure therapy for me. Exposure therapy is key because the more you do it, you realize that quickly differentiating what's emergent and what's not. And what's not, you have ample time to figure out. And as long as you get good with the emergencies, which frankly are not, they don't hide from you. Like the emergencies come and slap you in the face much of the time. And then to be nuanced enough to understand what, where and how they hide, the phobia diminishes with time. And just by hanging out with neurologists and spending more time getting that clinical training, I'm hoping that this becomes a phobia that we can shut the door on in years to come. So neurophilia might be the ultimate treatment plan.
Austin, you might be the first medical professional that I have heard in a very long time say that you want to hang out with neurologists. This is great. I have nothing else to say. This podcast is over. Neurology is cool again. Like, this is music to my ears. I hope everybody heard it. I wanted to highlight it. Austin wants to, I don't know if that says more about neurology changing and you think it's cool or more about you and maybe he's not
more
wearing a bow tie. For anyone who's listening, he does not have a bow tie on. So
there were no brownies that I had before or during the taping of this episode.
I love it. And I would agree with him. The more we're exposed, the better that is. And, you know, I'm one who tends to talk out loud as well, as I've got something in front of me that's a big concern. And so that's very helpful to me as well. And knowing that I have a team of neurologists close by that we can consult, I think is very, very helpful. Whether it be virtual, Austin, or whether it be by phone, or whether it be in person. I think formats like this also make a huge difference, to be able to talk about that and know that folks that have been out, you know, 15, 20, 30 years have experienced that. I think is very important to be able to have that conversation. Face our fears, know what you don't know, know what you do know, and feel confident with asking the right questions.
Beautifully said. I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, thank you so much, Drs. Veletko, Plate, and Fredrickson, for being on the Neurophilia podcast and taking some time out of your day to share your wisdom and some stories with our audience. Before we conclude, I want to ask you, Dr. Plate and Dr. Fredrickson, about your no-brainers. And these are going to be five rapid-fire questions that you can respond to with one word or one sentence maximum. So are you ready to go?
Ready to go.
Okay. What was your favorite part of this conversation?
Favorite part is Nuper and Austin, both of students of mine that are excelling in the world of medicine. Very proud. Thanks.
I'm still dying from the brownie story. I had to mute myself. That was pretty ridiculous. But yes, I felt that viscerally.
Who inspired you to go into medicine?
I have a mother who's a teacher and was superintendent of schools, and a father that was a hospital administrator. So this was easy for me to do. So medicine was where I was headed.
I don't know if you guys trained with him, but Dennis Lunny was my parents' physician. And he proved you could be a physician and a father and a philosopher and just a gentleman, all here in simple Salem, Ohio. So I wanted to be just like him ever since.
I love that.
I love that. What was an alternative career you considered?
Pharmacy for me. Actually started my first quarter back then, tells you how long ago it was, in pharmacy. My parents thought it was a great profession for a female. It still continues to be an excellent profession for anybody. And it certainly has expanded. But I made that switch during my first quarter in undergrad.
I was thinking about being an apple farmer, but all the apple farms, the farmers weren't old enough yet. So maybe before our time is done, I can transition careers out in rural America.
I see that for you, Dr. Fredrickson. I do see that for you. Favorite music to listen to?
I'm an 80s girl, and so 70s, 80s music genre. Love the Eagles. Love anything from the 80s, because that is when I was certainly growing up. How about you, Austin?
I think there was a group called the Code Blues or something like that.
There was.
That I heard Docs Who Rock a couple of years ago when Def Leppard was jamming. That's probably the pinnacle right there. I don't know if it gets better than that.
We'll leave it at that.
People can go look that up if they are. So
that's right.
And, you know, last question. What are you most proud of?
Most proud of my two children. I have a wonderful husband who has helped raise them, but I have two children. One of them is a urologist. He is chief resident this year between SUMA and General, and is going on to a fellowship at WashU in St. Louis. Very proud of Ethan. And my daughter is a fourth grade math teacher, who's a fabulous teacher with the lineage of my mom and her teaching skills. So very proud of those two.
Well, no offense to my four children, but I'm going to honestly say that I think it's you specifically, Nuper, but also symbolically. So seeing the trainees and the students who you put very little and they just bloom into these outstanding clinicians and people and leaders, I can just see how much better you leave things. And this podcast is such a great example of seeing a problem, and instead of sitting back and bitching about it, no, I'm actually going to go do something. I'm going to make myself better and leave this place better. And so I honestly can't say enough about how proud we are of you and all of the trainees out there like you doing this good work for patients. This is why we got to hang out with neurologists more, Dr. Plate. We just got to, these guys are the best.
We got to sign this guy. We got to sign this guy up. We need to talk more. I'm going to give you I'm going to give you my phone number. And just once a day, if you could just text me one of these nice phrases about neurologists, it's just going to give me that little extra push in my day to get through it. So
I love that.
We'll get something set up. We'll leave a comment in the episode notes so that everyone can subscribe to Daily Neurology Uplifters.
In this episode, we discuss the relationship between neurology and medicine, specialization in medicine, and the need and importance of patient advocacy. Thank you so much to our guests and to you, our audience, for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a review and follow us at Neurophilia Pod for updates on future episodes. In our next episode, we will discuss the relationship between neurology and infectious disease. See you then.